Good morning, brothers and sisters and fellow students. We'll continue this morning in the Signs of the Times under Israel 2004. And in case I failed to mention it yesterday, what Israel is looking for is to dwell in a secure country. That's in your outline, I think. I know it's on the front page of the outline. I thought we would start at anti-Semitism in Europe, which is, as we all are aware, is flourishing. I had an article that appeared in the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Can you hear me okay? I was getting a funny feedback.
Try again.
Okay. Can you hear me now? No. That's the trouble with these electronic gadgets or whatever they are. We're going to talk about technology in a minute. I can talk loud enough, but I'd be afraid to try it. This is an article that appeared in the Richmond Times-Dispatch in June of this year. And the caption, Anti-Semitism raises again its ugly head in Europe. And as we begin to move now, we can't avoid looking at things happening in Europe. The European Union will come into focus shortly, as well as the papacy. This was written by a gentleman named Tommy Baer, and to link the article, and I'm just going to excerpt a couple of statements from it. But I think this helps us to see the movement of Russia, the European Union, as well as certain Muslim countries. We'll also keep in mind that there is a change. People are so interested in what's going on with the Arab people. There is a change already, being accomplished, as we saw by this map. There is a treaty with Egypt, there's a treaty with Jordan, Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and a couple of other countries that have trading arrangements with Israel. They're quiet because they have their own problems and they don't need Israel adding to it. But we'll note that the real problem with Israel is far to the north of, with the Israeli people, is far to the north of that. Now I realize that the response always comes, well, look at the Palestinians. Well, the Palestinians are a very small group compared to these other large countries and also the influence. And I would caution us and each of us to remember that ultimately Esau and Jacob ben Israel became friends. In fact, they met at the burial of their father and seemed to be somewhat at peace. Also, all the Ishmaelites, they've got a change coming. How and when and why, we just have to keep looking. But remember, to the north, there is major problems. And Mr. Baer writes this in this article. He says, a recent poll conducted by the European Union found that Israel was the greatest threat to world peace. That's an interesting observation from the European Union. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we move into that. But he comments, not Iran or North Korea, not Islamic extremists, not even Al-Qaeda, but Israel, a strategic ally of the United States and the only democratic state in the Middle East, a tiny nation of 6 million Jews surrounded by 250 million Arabs. And they're the threat to world peace. Recently, French President Chirac uttered There is no anti-Semitism in France. This, despite the fact of firebombings of Jewish schools, synagogues, violent acts committed against Jews and Jewish property across France, where, as in all other parts of Europe, mainstream publications regularly engage in Israel bashing, and some even question the very legitimacy of the Jewish state. I guess that's enough of it. A subsequent article says, and this just addresses the issue of France, and this is in July 4th, 2004, Richmond paper. Israel sees surge, this is the state of Israel now, sees surge of immigration by French Jews. Some Jewish leaders in France contend that the Jewish agency has sent squads of emissaries to recruit Jews for Aliyah, or the return to Israel. France has 500,000 to 600,000 Jews, the largest population in Europe. And I think I had one other one, which I don't seem to put, I'll just tell you it. There's been a tremendous increase in Jews moving from France to Israel. I think it's gone from like 100 a year to almost 2,000 per year. Of course, it's great when you think of that percentage, but it's still a small number going. Now, I was going to copy this for you, and I find it's already in your outline. Israel's new normalcy. I'm not sure it's probably, you should see it. It's that article from May 10th time. I just want to call attention to one point that maybe I wasn't aware of it until Sister DeVita brought it to my attention later. But in the first, it says tens of thousands gathered confidently. And remember, we Christadelphians, we like that word, in public places for Independence Day. That would have been in May of this year. So if you think that has any connection with dwelling safely or dwelling confidently in Ezekiel 38, that's a thought that you can keep in your mind. All right. It seems Labour and Likud are about to enter into a coalition to keep the Sharon government from falling. If this happens, Mr. Peres, who's now 80 years old and a major factor in peace operations of the past, will be the coalition partner from the Labour Party. And that's a point I think we should keep a close watch on as we move into this. Somebody here this week suggested, we were discussing about what Sharon may do relative to his next move, and it's, I believe it's a possibility that if Iran gets out of line, and that probably means continuing to try to develop a nuclear weapon or nuclear bomb, that Sharon is going to take a very significant act, make a very significant act. It could be anything, similar to what Mr. Begin did back in the late 70s when he bombed Baghdad to destroy that nuclear plant that Saddam Hussein was, you know, working on. So I think it helps me focus at least that things are moving in the direction that that Christadelphians for over a century have seen coming to pass. The USA and the UK, for many reasons, continue to support Israel. Fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan put these two friends in the same corner. Joint military exercises are held and intelligence sources are work together with the Israeli Mossad, and this is going to become of
increasing value. Milestones 2003, I believe, which is another source I've used for some of these remarks, mentions that the largest training base in the Middle East by the USA now used is in the middle of Israel. I'm not sure anyone knows exactly where it is, but we keep in mind that the British and the Americans have built many military bases in the region that would be close to the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, including a couple of the smaller islands in the sea, and that's going to continue. If we think that Mr. Bush, number one, when he went to the Persian Gulf in 1991, he said, "We'll be here a few months, we'll clean up, and then we're going to leave." Well, I think the thought was at that time, by at least the believers, that that was never going to happen. The USA and the United Kingdom are there for the duration, and that means until Christ comes. The U.S. peace plan has brought time to enable Sharon to clean up problems in Gaza and the West Bank. The Sharon government now moves closer to labor in the talk of a Palestinian state. These centrist ideas will probably prolong the conflict and lack of peace. Every Hamas killing and show of power adds to the security improvement. That's a strange thing to say, but what's really happened is the Israelis have, by killing the leaders, they're now having difficulty, the Hamas, that is having difficulty continuing to supply their terrorist organization with leaders to sponsor these bombings. The security wall, which we mentioned yesterday, has also helped in that. Iraq and Iran and also Syria will keep problems brewing to allow the U.S. and the U.K. to remain. We've talked about agreements between some of the allies in the area who have become allies with, at least, albeit quiet, with Israel. Now, we have to mention Israeli technology, which helps both the Israeli budget and its military standing, including defense and intelligence gathering. I don't think we can in any way underestimate the military strength of Israel. It is in large measure as a result of technology, because small mobile armies are today as vital as, you know, a large military complex. Technology has brought Israel to the forefront. And Israel is, of course, very happy and suggests always that they are, you know, they're happy with what they've done in their strengthening themselves. And we suggested, and I think this is probably one of the outstanding chapters in a biblical setting to kind of explain to us the latter-day Israeli might, and ask you to read 2 Chronicles 26 if you had a chance, I'm just going to run through a couple of the verses. I tell you, this thought comes from Brother Cowie in his analysis of the kings of Israel and Judah. And I don't happen to have it with me, but if you have that little work, you can take a look at it. It's very good, and I think he wrote that around 1975, so it's about 20 years old, but you can bring it. What he said is all true, but yet we've seen almost 30 years added to that. And well, what's said here is you can take it wherever you think it should be taken. Uzziah's name means strength of Yahweh, a mighty one of Yahweh. And, you know, the name alone implies something to us, I think. But we'll just look at a few of the verses. Verse 5 says, well, let's look. It says he built Eloah and restored it to Judah. After that, the king slept with his fathers. That's his father. And Uzziah came to power. In verse 6, it says, he went forth and warred against the Philistines and brake down the wall of Gath and the wall of Jabneh and the wall of Ashdod and built cities about Ashdod and among the Philistines. And God helped him, or El helped him against the Philistines. And that's a, you know, that's a point that needs to be absorbed in our minds, that this whole battle that and the building and strengthening of his army that Uzziah went through, it was of God. It was of Yahweh. And verse 7-8 says, he strengthened himself exceedingly. He fortified the valley in verse 9, turning of the wall and fortified them, these cities. He built towers in the land. He loved husbandry. Notice the association with Israel today. Moreover, in verse 11, he had a host of fighting men that went out to war. And those under his hand were 300,700 and 500 that made war against with mighty power to help the king against his enemy. It gets more specific in verses 14 and 15, where it speaks of he had slings to cast stones. Well, you know, how would that be described, 700 B.C.? He made in Jerusalem engines invented by cunning men to be on the towers and upon the bulwarks to shoot arrows and great stones withal. It's a great description, I think, of, you know, missiles being fired. And that's what, you know, the Israeli army is all about. His name spread far abroad, for he was marvelously helped till he was strong. And that tells us a real nice picture of Israel as it developed from 47 to present. And today, I don't think anyone would question that Israel is amongst the most powerful nations on earth. Really, nobody knows how strong they are. And I would suggest that the only that Mr. Sharon or whoever, Mr. Begin, when he was prime minister, which was when this power really expanded, shared it with very few people. I heard Mr. Begin speak once, and I can remember he was quite an old man, very feeble. They had to help him to the podium. And when he got there, he delivered a very stirring lecture. And he said, you know, we have much technology. This was at the time that Israel was buying F-16s from the U.S. and then modifying them, which is part of the agreement that the U.S. had with Saudi Arabia. We'll sell you F-16s, but you can't have a modified version. The modified version was done in Israel, and it used by the Israeli forces. Of course, the U.S. wanted the modified versions sent back to them. And I can remember Mr. Begin said, we are going to share that technology with our friends, but we first have to determine who are our friends. And I think, remember, Mr. Begin and Mr. Sharon were... Sharon was his defense minister, and that's where all the troubles start. But when we think of Mr. Sharon, we think of a hawk. He's developed the policies, or continued the policies, of Menachem Begin, and these two are not going to use that technology except as it benefits their state. Uh, to technology for a minute. Sister Charlotte and I heard President Wiseman speak in probably 1990, I'm not sure what year, but I can remember his statement at that time, and he was speaking to a Jewish audience, and he said Israel, well, the Jewish audience was Balkan, because when they came to Israel, they were wiretapped and things of that sort for security reasons, and they were saying, you know, we don't want to be wiretapped. And Mr. Wiseman says, well, let me tell you something. You're going to be wiretapped, whether you want to be or not. And apparently, then when they would call back and forth to New York or to Richmond or Orlando to their friends, the Israeli intelligence would wiretap. They didn't like it. They're complaining there to the president of Israel about it. And he says, look, if you don't like it, don't call. If you don't agree with our policies, stay where you are. If you agree with our policies, make all of y'all and come to Israel and live. And then you can vote. But you can't vote and live in New York. So one of these kind of talkative ladies said, began to speak about how much money they contributed to Israel. And he says, you know, we don't really need your money. He says, we are independently wealthy of your gifts and contributions. We appreciate them, but we don't need them. We have been made wealthy by the chip. And I don't mean the potato chip. So, I took that at that time listening, and that's the confidence that Israel has. You know, I think it's played down. The press doesn't want to accept it, and the enemies don't want to hear it. And there was a combination between the press and whoever influences the press to bash Israel as a result of some of that that awareness that Israel is not going to be mistreated, the populace, because of the power that the military have, and that it flows into the spaces is really technology. You and I, and as we read through 2 Chronicles 30:26, notice it's all of God. It says, you know, three or four times in that chapter, they were strengthened by Yahweh. Or they were strengthened, frequently it doesn't say Yahweh, it says the Elohim. And, you know, this ties us very, should tie us very well to Brother Jimmy's class, when he is talking about the cherubim. And but we should be aware that there's no telling how many angels or cherubic figures are active in this control in Israel, and as we will move to Europe, also in the affairs of men in Europe, in Russia, in Tarshish. It doesn't matter where we look, Yahweh is in control through the Elohim. Legions of angels, or myriads of angels, if you want to think about it. And I think that's something that I can tell you, I think as a real body of people, you and I, Christadelphians, have really missed convincing our children of the activity of angels in the world. You know, David says that the angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him. Put one of the, no question, one of the things that made David the great man that he was the awareness that he had an angel who looked after him. He had more visible contact, no doubt, but you and I, they are unseen. Well, we, you know, we mention providence a lot, but we mention it really without being conscious, at least for me. I'm not as conscious as I should be that there are angels unseen monitoring us and controlling us. You know, I mentioned yesterday when Mr. Sharon, and we'll see that a little bit when we get into the economic union. You know, these prime ministers would go into meetings having no intentions of signing an agreement, but they sign. Sharon and Bush speak, And I'm not, I believe that a lot of what they say to each other is controlled by the by this angelic host that make changes in their what they say. So, you know, humanism can't accept anything like that because they think that, you know, man is great, is getting better all the time, and are not aware of the control that Yahweh exhibits. Nothing is to alter his purpose. But Brother Thomas, and I think I have that in the Tarshish notes, he says that, speaking of Tarshish at that time, he says it doesn't matter what they think or what the statesmen of the of their leadership think, they will do what Yahweh directs. That's something we need to keep in mind. Brother Thomas wrote that in El Pasisro. I think we may read it later. Okay? All right. On Israel 2004, the conclusion, and this is a feeble attempt to make us think back a little bit to the messianic growth too. As we have seen messianic growth, we see 6 million Israelis now as a powerful nation on the in the air, on the land, and in the seas. Tarshish will be there. Russia will think an evil thought. Jerusalem will fall, but Yahweh will intervene, destroying the northern invader. And we obviously know that intervention by Yahweh is at the hand of Christ and the saints. We call it the rainbowed angel phase of these conflicts. Let's turn to Ezekiel 39, and read 1 through 4. This is a conclusion. Remember in chapter 38, and we'll talk about 38 a little bit later, more relative to Tarshish and Gog of the land of Magog. But this is the chapter that 38 sets forth the Russia thinking an evil thought, saying, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages, to them that dwell confidently in their land, dwelling without walls. And, you know, thinking about the wall, that's an interesting play because, you know, if there's a wall around Russia's friend in the area and no wall around their enemy, Israel, then that phrase unwalled could be probably easily used. You know, it's you have to think through that. A young brother pointed that out to me, and it took me a long time to get it to sink through. Also, Sheba and Dedan, Natasha's power is mentioned in 13, verse 13. And then as we come to 19, and this is the conclusion of the matter, it says, therefore, son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus saith Yahweh Elohim, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and leave but a sixth part of thee, and will cause thee to come up from the north parts, and will bring thee upon the mountains of Israel, and I will smite the bowl of thy left hand, and will cause thine arrows to fall out of the right hand, and thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands, and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous beasts of every sort, and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. Thou shalt fall upon the open field, I have spoken it, said Yahweh Elohim. We'll also look at Zechariah 14 and read the first 4 verses. Same time, I should say slightly previous, but in just a matter of perhaps months or even weeks, but it carries us to the same end. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided. I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall fall. We talked about that. And then in verse 3 it says, then shall Yahweh go forth and fight against those enemies, as he fought in the day of battle. And his feet, and that his there is again, that plural, the rainbowed angel, shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof, and there will be the daily great earthquake. Okay, so with that, let's turn to Europe. 2004, and this is on Europe 2004. Okay, what does Europe want? They want to be a United States of Europe, a super state. You know, really, the symbols EEC, EC, and EU speak to the, that tells the whole story. You know, the European Economic Community, the European Community, and then the European Union. That's a progression of the same, and it took place over many, many years. I don't know how much time we're going to have to start this. There is an attachment to your outline. It comprises 14 pages, I believe, entitled Rome and the European Union. We'll use some of that when we talk about the papacy, but we want to use some of it as we deal with the the European Union. But I'm going to follow just some notes on it, and then we'll fill in the rest of it tomorrow anyway. If in the meantime you have a chance to read through those 14 pages, it'll help us time-wise here. Let me tell you this much about it. That was written by two fellows whose name were in the outline. The one that I'm more familiar with is Richard Bennett. Richard Bennett was a priest in the Roman Catholic Church. So he speaks from within. He's of course obviously left the church, and he is he makes some tremendous statements, and there's a lot of attached that he sent that out when he had it appear on the internet, I believe. I'll tell you where I got it. Brother Lister, who lives in Guildford, England, published it in a little magazine he puts out called Apocalyptic Messenger. Superb little magazine, but you can't, it's hard to read, and I couldn't read it in that, so I had Brother Brian pull it off the internet, so I got the whole thing here, and it's worth reading. But anyway, the plan for the European Union was designed by the Catholic Church from the early 20th century. Now you can get all kinds of books and all kinds of literature, and unless you get somebody writing who has a religious appreciation of what's going on from the prophets, they'll never say that. In fact, the great book that I'm going to recommend to everybody called The Great Deception by Booker and North, and I have a copy of it, I'll show you. You may look at it later. We'll bring it up later. And I get it and take a look at it. But nowhere in that is it ever mentioned Roman Catholicism, the Vatican, any of the popes, anything. Yet, this plan was designed by the church. And I think you'll see that when we read Rome and the European Union. The early designers were all Roman Catholic, and as the plan developed, Most of the work was deceptive. That's a quote from the, the word being deceptive is a quote from Booker and North. Many of those who worked to develop the plan have been recognized by the Pope to begin the process to become saints. That's a kind of a Monet and a Psalter and a couple others. They have been, the process is started by the Pope to, for them to become saints. The economic treaties, well, I've got four of them here that he's recommended. Bonnet, Adenauer, Dolores, and Schumann. And there will obviously be others as this work develops. The economic treaties began with and the acronyms in this book are awful. ECSC, which I finally found out means Economic Coal and Steel Commission. And it began in approximately 1925. And you can see immediately what was being done was they were telling all these countries, this is an economic treaty. We come together for trade purposes, just like the WTO, the World Trade Organization. We get together, we trade with each other, and we're not influenced by all that. We can avoid wars, we can avoid conflicts by economics. When I read this book, I'll tell you, I don't think Brother Lou's not here, so I can tell this, right? The first name I ran into was a fellow named Louis, L-O-C-H-L-E-U-R. Now, I'm not a Frenchman, so I don't know how you pronounce that, but I thought, boy, this must have been some of Lou's relatives, many years ago. And I've asked him about that. Oh, Lou is here. But we couldn't determine whether it was or not. But I've had to pronounce that Locklear. Arthur Salter, and later in 1931, Jean Monnet saw the plan for a U.S. of Europe as workable. This began a work of 30 years. Great Deception, pages 13 to 16. That our community is not a coal and steel producers association, it is the beginning of Europe. That was from Jean Monnet, Jan, have you say it. May 25th, 1957, the signing of the Treaty of Rome by six governments marked the birth of the EEC. Rome was selected as the city of signing because of its symbolic significance, cited as a city which for 2,000 years under the Roman Empire and the papacy has stood at the center of European history. Countries at the beginning included Belgium, France, Italy, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, and West Germany. That was in 1973, three more joined, Britain, Ireland, Denmark, with Spain. Portugal, with Spain, Portugal, Greece joining between 80 and 86. The names EC and EC and EU show the progression of the development from supposedly an economic trade group to a union that speaks of unity in all matters, political, military, monetary, and laws, and ultimately religion. That is a return to pre-Reformation control by the Roman Catholic Church. We're going to leave that intrigue issue till after we get into the papacy story, because I want to jump us into our time, kind of. Now comes the ratification of the Constitution. The time that will bring finality to the merging of the 25-27 countries. This was the plan from the early date of Monet, but never was the final plan made known. We believe the Vatican and the Catholic organizations at the top level knew what would eventually evolve. R. Bennett, that's Richard Bennett, a former priest, certainly has that belief. The Constitution in draft form is designed to give the European authority over, is to give European authority over all member states. And that constitution is to be in excess of 300 pages. I think the last count I saw, and it's up to around 330 pages. Polls taken in June of 2004 in the United Kingdom indicate that 49% of the Britons would vote no, 23% would vote for, and 28% undecided. Chirac has threatened to have the United Kingdom removed if she does not support the Constitution. I think that's probably something we need to look fairly carefully to see what happens. In the June elections, the electorate voted substantially with the UK Independence Party. That's a new acronym we're going to say, UKIP, UKIP, who are no to the European Constitution and want the United Kingdom to withdraw from the European Union. And that's going to be a major factor. If that happens, obviously in the election, the Tories will gain significantly and possibly could form a coalition government with the Tories, and there would be a possibility that Mr. Howard, a Jewish believer, would become prime minister. We'll talk more about that a little later. I have an article on this on him from I think it's from the Spectator. If any of you ever read the Spectator, Christadelphian had seen Britain's role as Tarsus or Tyre, and the young lions will expect the break with Europe to come before the final vote. Now, somebody asked me one recently. I think the final vote from the European Union point of view has to be before 06. So, you know, there's a year to kick that around. Mr. Blair, who of course went into office non-supportive of the European Union, but managed to now change his mind without ever having any votes. But now he's in a box, because if he stays with that, he's going to probably be defeated in his role. Most writers that I've read think that his goal, Blair, is to be president of the European Union. Yeah, that's something, you know, I guess we can all contemplate. I'm not sure what he has in mind. I guess we watch with interest to see what Britain does. You know, if they leave, then a lot of what Christadelphians had believed for many years would be confirmed. If they stay, we got longer to wait. I don't think it's any question that we all know that eventually the Brits will not be in the European Union. And I'd like to get this way. I'm showing this slide only for one purpose right now, but it's to give us a little view of what we're looking at. I have another one in a minute for something else. What strikes me is, I can't see it up there down here, but you can see right here the Sea of Tarsus. This is from a very old Bible. And I suppose, you know, people that were reading the Bible and many years ago were aware that when you sailed out of Joppa to go to Tarshish, like Jonah, you were in what we today call the Mediterranean Sea. The British Isles are barely shown up right at the north of the map. And look back, you see, you notice Gomer, Meshach, Tubal, Magog, all those Russian sounding names, and along with Gomer, that's the group spoken of in
in Ezekiel 38. We all be familiar with it. What I think we're seeing form now is we're seeing well, let me show you a map of it. That's it. This came from Foreign Affairs, and was quite a while ago. It was a lengthy article written in that called The Clash of Civilizations. And the only purpose here is to, if you look at the line, that's the division of Western Christianity from Orthodox Christianity and Islam to the East. Within those, you have the two legs of the Roman Empire, East and Western Rome. And what's happening is the economic union, European Economic Union, is taking this part. Russia is taking that part. And it becomes another, with the division into the Community of Independent States, we refer to it as the CIS, including Ukraine and Afghanistan and those nations, those former Soviet Union countries around the Caspian Sea, which doesn't all show on here, but we're going eastward. That's the other leg of what's being developed. Okay. And I won't go further than I want or than I had planned. But that's okay. I need the time later. Anybody have any comments, questions to this point? We've got about 7-8 minutes. I know you have thoughts and ideas.
This thing out here would suggest that Turkey will be unsuccessful in getting into the EU. Do you agree with that? If they're going to be in the Eastern Alliance?
Turkey will be unsuccessful in getting. I'm not sure.
I have a thought. Darryl may have a thought.
Well, it'd be very difficult for Turkey to get in, but they have a Muslim background. I was going to say it could happen, but you do know they would be drawn that way to most Russia.
That would be my thought is that, you know, when Russia moves southward to protect their interest in the Black Sea area, they will take Constantinople, and that'll be a part of the formation of the ultimate great kingdom of men, both standing upon both legs, if that is. In other words, Brother Thomas thought that, you know, what we really looked for was ultimately the Constantinople coming under the domination of Russia, under the domination of God. Well, when that happens, that would be, Turkey could be either in or out, and it maybe wouldn't make any difference, because ultimately they will be assimilated into that northern group. Yeah. You got to talk louder.
The Turks were splint on the eastern bank.
Okay.
And therefore has to be replaced by the Orthodox Catholic, not Orthodox Catholic, on the east.
Right. I think what we are seeing is all these countries, and maybe this one is more confusing. What struck me when I saw it in this of Foreign Affairs was the division. This was put in there about the time of the Yugoslav conflict. And you know, we all, and probably most of us, or many of us, spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the Bosnian conflict was all about. At least I did. I searched and searched and searched to see what was the influence of the Catholic Church in it. And you know, you never could find anything written. Finally, after about 4 years of it, I found out it was really a conflict between the Serbs and the Croats, which were Eastern Church and the Western Church. The Roman Catholics were very much involved in it, and Russia got into it, at least in theory, because they were supportive of the Serbs. They were supportive of the Eastern Church. And, you know, look, they've been fighting for 1,000 years, and it's, that's why I do have a thought that it'll be a very limited time that this image can stand up, because think of the conflicts that are built within this group of nations. They're all still very nationalistic. I mean, the Germans don't like the French, and the French don't like the Germans. The French are very supportive of the economic union, European Union, only because they want to control it. And they're going to control it through the Pope. That's their intentions. Now think, what's going to happen is by the time they get control of it, Putin's going to decide that he wants to be in control. So there we'll have a negotiation between the papacy and Russia. Well, Russia will agree to the military strength and the domination of it secularly. And the Pope, what does the Pope want? What he's always said he wants. He wants to control he now says Europe on Catholic principles.
Yeah. Say, throughout the years, has Constantinople been referred to as the Second Rome, and then now, even later, Russia being referred to as the Third Rome, so it right. connects all the places in both legs,
sure.
Western and Eastern.
Good point, and what we should really see is a sign, see all these, we see it all coming together. We see the image now ready to stand. And that's the sign of the times that we should be. In fact, just preparing on these classes, it's a real job to separate the papacy from Europe and also from Russia, because they all have comparable goals once they can tie this religious action together. Yeah, Darrell.
I can see now in my mind why this area. Russia into the flag and also Turkey, because there's a large faction of Muslims in the former Yugoslavian country, and they hate each other because the Muslims slaughtered the Serbs back in the 1300s or whatever, and vice versa. And if one or the other gets in a pinch, when those two get divided again, both of those countries, Russia,
I think that's an absolute possibility. What's going to happen to the Muslims is very difficult. I just was looking this morning at something, and as in round numbers, there's about 2.2 billion. Christians in the world, of which obviously, you know, 90% of them are Roman Catholic, or Eastern Church, which is the same, will be the same. And in the Muslim world, it's about 1,300,000. And I went through this. I was kind of avoiding it, because I don't like to get into the Muslim interest, because it gets so much more complex. But the Muslims and the Jews are both being treated with anti-Semitic acts, and that's a thing that could bring the Muslims closer to the Jews by saying, well, you know, in France, we're both being persecuted. In the world image, we're both being persecuted. So, you know, you, Ishmael, and we, Isaac, and I'm using it in a very worldly sense, you know, we're closer, we've got a common enemy. And one thing about the Muslims, you know, they follow
they follow their leader. You know, you could probably have 10 real leaders in the Muslim community that could move the Muslim population. Maybe I'm not familiar enough with them to say much, but I think it's interesting in a way to see the Muslims and the Jews being similarly persecuted. And you know, when you come down, this is true with you and I. You know, our real enemy in a religious sense is the Pope, the Roman Catholic Church. You know, our forefathers, our ancestors, from the early days of Protestantism, we came from a German background, a French background, or an English background, we were persecuted by the Roman Church. And the Roman Church is still smaltering over the fact that they lost out. And, you know, think about, and we're going to look at it when we get to the papacy, but think about the time coming when no man can buy or sell except he have the mark of the beast. That happened, really, in what we call the Middle Ages. My opinion is that it's going to happen again. All you have to do is have this group of nations get the power, and they will immediately begin the persecutions. Be Catholic or die. We'll read tomorrow from some of this. The Pope has made it very clear. If you're not associated with Roman Catholicism, you have no salvation. And then we'll talk about the church also as to how they view they have enough internal problems, which they don't deal with, when they have a real problem, and they've had a lot of them recently. Who always serves as the mediator? Who searches out the problem? Another one of them. I mean, I noticed they took some cardinal the other day, and he's gonna review what's happened in the church in these ghastly misbehavior involvements. Okay.